and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, show tunes, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it, and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 8, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a man who's been a journalist, magazine editor, magazine owner, podcaster, and general bon vivant stro raconteur. His work has appeared in places like The Economist, Boing Boing, Macworld, and The Magazine, and in past lives he's even been a typesetter, a graphic designer, conference planner, and if you believe everything you read, even a professional granola maker. He's also a podcaster with his own show, The New Disruptors, and as a guest on many other people's shows, but he's probably best known simply as Glenn, that guy off the internet who won Jeopardy a couple of times. Not that he'd ever mention it himself. He is, of course, Mr. Glenn Fleischman. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And yeah, it's Glenn. It's usually the form is Glenn, all capital letters, in a gesture of remonstration at my terrible punning on Twitter. That's the usual form. Glenn!
The other thing you're very well known for, yes. So welcome to the show. Now, you are, let's be honest, we are stretching the format a little bit this week. But I think it's worth doing and worth talking about. And that is because you've chosen something that isn't necessarily maligned by its target audience, but by everybody else, which I think is going to be interesting. So tell us what it is and give us some context around its release and why you think it should be more appreciated than it is.
Well, I picked Kim Possible, and I feel like it ran on the Disney Channel in America. And I think, I'm not actually sure, you can buy it on iTunes. I'm not sure how widely available it is. I don't know if it's on streaming services, for instance. You know, I haven't checked, isn't that funny? But it was a series that ran from 2002 to 2007. I had to look up the details. I forgot it ran that long. 4 seasons, and it was typical of Disney to run an animated series not indefinitely. They would run it for a stretch of time and then rerun it forever. But it was very clever. It was clearly, at least initially, aimed at kind of a teen audience that still thought cartoons were okay. It was something tolerable to watch. That wasn't for, you know, toddlers or 10-year-olds. It had great protagonists, great villains. And I don't know if it was conceived this way, but it very, very quickly became what I think is the Bullwinkle and Rocky of our time, like, or of that time, so a decade ago, where the show nominally is about a teenage female hero. It's a little Buffy-like, so it came after Buffy, and I think they were modeling it on the success of Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a live-action show. So she's not slaying vampires or dealing with the undead. She's a cheerleader, but she's like an extremely kind, nice person with an incredible diverse variety of like friends, like both, you know, racially, ethnically, intelligence, social strata. So she's sort of like the perfect high school kid, but she also happens to be just accidentally really athletic. Her parents are brilliant. Her brothers, she has 2 twin brothers who are horrible to her, and she falls into becoming essentially an international, not a spy, everyone knows who she is, but she's like a fixer, like there's a problem, and they call her, and her computer buddy arranges some military force to come and pick her up, and they fly her somewhere in the world, and she defeats some ridiculous but very interesting supervillain, and it's all you know, generally pretty lighthearted, but there was more depth to it, I think, than a lot of people appreciated. So it's not, I don't know if people had a bad attitude about it. I think it's more unknown. And if you mention Kim Possible to most people, they would think like, either they would never have heard of it, or they think like, why are you watching a kid's show? Why are you watching a Disney show for teenage girls? A little of the My Little Pony kind of sentiment before there were bronies and so forth. So I'm an unabashed fan of the show. It was beautifully animated. Is very funny, extremely well written, some of the best character voices in the business, and my only regret is that they only did 4 seasons of it. There weren't enough shows.
Yeah, as I said, it's not necessarily, I think the target audience probably enjoyed it. The fact that it ran for 4 seasons would suggest that. But yeah, most people have probably never heard of it, or would certainly, and with the animation style as well, it's not like something like, say, Thundercats, which had a very sort of superhero comic-like visual appeal, whereas Kim Possible is done in a very, not quite as abstract as something like Dexter's Lab, but that sort of very cartoony cartoon. It's not something that you'd look at and a teenager would immediately go, oh, that looks cool.
I think Dexter's Lab is a great example too, because Dexter's Lab was ostensibly for kids. It was much, you're right, more abstract. Like it was definitely somewhere, it wasn't exactly anime by any means, but it was definitely more towards some kind of stylized, not Art Deco, but it had this stylized feel of it. Everything was sort of, you know, interesting edges. That art, the animator, was it Gennady?
Art Deco is actually not a bad way of putting it, is it? It's, yeah.
It wasn't the, it was more the abstraction was Art Deco as opposed to it looking like an Art Deco thing. But so Dexter's Lab, there was so much in there for adults. There was an episode called The Beat Alls that was about this four supervillains with the Powerpuff. Oh, I'm thinking Powerpuff Girls. Oh, that's right. Well, they ran. God, they were running.
Yes.
So similar. That's right. I forget. Powerpuff Girls is another example where that show really was a lot of winks and nods to people as well. But Dexter's Lab was full of all this stuff. And so, like, Bullwinkle is the classic. It's 50 years old or more now, 50 years old. I'm showing it to my kids recently who are 7 and 10. And they appreciate it on the level of the goofiness. But everything in Bullwinkle and Rocky is like, there's a little joke for the adults. There's so much of a subtext, things that aren't stated or little side notes or whatever. And it's sophisticated. So it has this top level that's slapstick and ridiculous and funny in its own right. And then it has a bottom level that the kids can be completely unaware of until they get older. And it is completely sophisticated. It's like, dressing or a drawing room comedy almost at the more like high British farce. Totally pitched. It's not Noel Coward, but it's totally pitched at the adults. And I feel like Kim Possible captured that, where it's not a thin plot. Like there's how many cartoons you watch where there's one plot. We need to get this thing. We do this thing. Another thing happens. And then you're done. And I've watched those idly over the years. This show actually had a surprising amount of depth, but I feel like it's an undiscovered thing, because if it had come out a few years later, it would have been, it's a little, you know, it is au courant, like the internet existed and they had cell phones and it doesn't seem dated from a technology standpoint, but I think this would have been something that would become like a cultish thing if it was streaming on Netflix or been released and then immediately available. I think people would have had more of a direct connection to it and recognize. Instead, I think it's more ignored than disdained, let's say.
Mm. Yeah, you may be right. I mean, I only know about this because I happen to have a friend who works in kids TV, and he was working at Disney at the time this was being made. He didn't work on it. He wasn't staff, but, you know, in the same corporation. So obviously he was aware of it. And he, having spent his entire career in kids TV, pretty much, it very much appreciates good kids TV stuff that has, as you say, those multiple levels, like a good Pixar movie, something that is, you know, the kids can watch and enjoy on their own level, but adults can watch it and not just be bored out of their minds, because there's something, there's a level there for them, which, as you say, doesn't get in the way of the ostensible kids fiction, but is nevertheless there to be appreciated if you're old enough to see it.
That's exactly it. And I think the degree of care to which Disney put into this program, I want to say, is sort of extraordinary, although then we've seen shows after that that have had the same degree of quality of animation and script writing and script writing for cartoons and, you know, animated movies and cartoons has, you know, so a friend of mine, her brother is David X. Cohen, who's the co-creator of Futurama. And so I got a little insight into that. Went to a table reading once of what was one of the many last tapings of Futurama. I got to sit there and see John DiMaggio and the other people read and meet a bunch of people. It was super fun. But the thing that happened, Futurama was a groundbreaking show in a bunch of ways. And it preceded, it was launched in 1998 or 9, I think, on Fox on broadcast television in America. And but Kim Possible, it really, at some level, has very little to do with John DiMaggio, with Futurama. John DiMaggio is in both series, Bender in Futurama and Dr. Draken highly recurring character in Kim Possible.
Oh, does he play Dr. Draken? That's a splendid performance.
It's the best thing. And so, but Futurama was, Simpsons had been on the air for years and years. Futurama came along, another show from Matt Groening, although David Cohen was the one who really, it was sort of his vision and he drove it, and Groening was, you know, big proponent of it and signed on and so forth. But it was a super smart show. It was full of science. It found it a hard time finding an audience because Fox didn't know what to do with it. It became kind of a cult thing. It was brought back from the dead, I think, three or four times. It's like the most canceled show in television history. But what it also did is one of the lead writers on the show wound up getting the Screenwriters Guild to accept cartoon and animation writers as full members. And that's why this is an obscure fact. The reason David X. Cohen is X, his middle initial is not X, his middle initial is S, but there was already a David S. Cohen in the guild. So he had to change his middle, he had to make a fake middle name. The little obscure things about how those work. But I think so Futurama, it didn't, I don't want to say legitimize, but it was a adult cartoon that I don't know if kids ever liked. Maybe they did. It was sort of ridiculous in the same way, but it was much more complicated to follow. There were shows, the best of the Futurama episodes had an A story, a B story, a C, D, E. I mean, I've counted out to like F or G that's going through, and at the end, they managed to pull it all off. So the writing of, I think, has been legitimized now in a way that wasn't maybe a decade or so ago. And then I think people, you know from your industries you're involved in, like, this is now serious work. This isn't, oh, that's an animated show. We can knock it out in an afternoon. We'll send it to South Korea and they'll produce some crud and we'll throw it up and the kids will love it. Now it's all, it's a big business and it's very serious. And, the best of the shows, like BoJack Horseman, I've just started to watch. The beginning is a little rough, and I've heard I need to get through episode two or three, and I think I'm in episode two now. But that show is on, it's Netflix original, and it's, you know, it's crazy. It's not, it's sort of adult themed and so forth, but it also is, it uses the medium of animation, which I think Kim Possible and Futurama and these other shows we're talking about, the medium of animation is not just the Honeymooners, but it's a cartoon, you know, which is what some people had said at times. The Simpsons sometimes is that. Sometimes The Simpsons is the most brilliant thing you see because they take advantage of the medium and they use it. So I think that's where Kim Possible, for me, it's fun, it's lighthearted, it's extremely well done, and it takes advantage of the fact that it's animated to do things that would be completely impossible or look terrible if it was live action.
That's very true. I liked the speed of it. One of the things I see often in shows, especially stuff aimed at kids, is things that go too slowly, that mm-hmm. move too slowly, and they seem to think they have to go at a snail's pace in order for kids to follow it, especially if there are jokes involved. I mean, to take a good example, say the JLA cartoon, the Justice League cartoons, which were very well regarded,
yes,
and
but
were generally, you know, very good cartoons, again, appeal to a wide spectrum of, you know, age ranges, but they were slow. There was nothing sort of quick fire about them. Now, whether that was a deliberate choice or whether that was just because they felt that was how animation was done at that time, it's hard to say, obviously. But one of the things I did like about Kim Possible was that, yeah, it felt like a good, fast comedy show. The jokes, they hang on the jokes just long enough for it to be funny, and then they move on, which is what a good comedy show will do and what a good cartoon should do. But yeah, all too often they're not. They're much slower. So I thought that was interesting.
It's also the thing, that thinness I was mentioning earlier that comes through. Like JLA is, I think like Batman the Animated Series was rich and it was quiet. And when that came out, that was an extraordinary thing. I remember watching it on. I was out of college, I think, and I would sit there and watch the thing and stare at the screen, you know, because there had never been anything on television that was that quiet before. You'd have to go to like really obscure, you know, Japanese movies to find things with that pacing. And I think JLA, I think they, and a couple of the series like it, they kept the look and feel and sort of some of the mood, and especially some of the darkness, some of the themes, but they didn't get the pacing right. As you say, the shows were, there wasn't enough underneath it. They just went slow and they weren't layered. Kim Possible has that multi-plot thing. It's not a Futurama to that extent. And there were some seasons of Futurama later where they did become a little thin at times, where either maybe they were writing them too fast, or they just didn't have the same kind of oomph behind it, and then I feel they regained their steam. But in, you know, any Kim Possible episode, there's usually some main theme. There is some struggle. They're in high school, and it's sort of the Buffy thing. Like, Buffy's trying to not flunk out of classes, but she's also, there's a hellmouth, you know? There's this hellmouth over here, and she's got to do something about it. And the same thing, Kim Possible's like, look, I've got this test, and my friend is mad at me, and now I'm in Switzerland, like, fighting a guy with lasers. And they could run those stories. The other thing I like, in terms of depth, is they had the running joke thing. Like, over four seasons, there are jokes that paid off in the last episodes. I just rewatched before taping. I rewatched the two-part finale, so I could remember, you know, some of those elements, and every single character, and they had so many secondary characters who are actually well fleshed out over, you know, four seasons of 22-minute episodes, and I feel like there's a great payoff when, you know, in the last episode you see a thing that maybe Community, like the TV show Community, maybe they set that up 2 years ago, or they remembered that they'd set something up 2 years ago, and there's the resolution in that last thing as they graduate high school. Again, very Buffy-like. You know, Buffy's season 1 to 3, I think, are considered like the best. And I think later, there's one later that people really like. And that's the high school years, because you're dealing with everything. It's universally relatable. You're under somebody else's thumb. There's a limited set of possibilities, and the plot sort of, the structure helps create a story because they're in high school. They have, you know, they're not off, they don't have the freedom, and I think that helps tell the story.
I hadn't made that Buffy connection before, but now that I think about it, actually, yeah, that is, you know, as you say, it came out sort of shortly afterwards. It's not a bad comparison. However, you say that when you mentioned the 22-minute format, it suddenly made me think, do you know what it actually reminded me of in some ways was a good sitcom.
Oh, yeah.
A standard studio sitcom, because it has that A plot and then the B plot underneath for a bit of light relief and the, you know, and then it all ties up at the end.
That's exactly it. You know, I hadn't thought about that. But it means they kept it fast paced. And I think, I don't know if they stuck to like the 3-act format, but they may have. But it just, it's zippy and it makes it more consumable. I also should mention, so do you remember Freakazoid? Did you ever see that? It was, I think it was Steven Spielberg show that was on. I got to look up the years while we're talking. I look up the years. It's from...
I'm not sure if that ever made it over to the UK, to be honest.
It was a very strange, it was for the Kids WB cartoon portion of the WB network, which you'll never have heard of because it's gone or it's changed. I don't know. And it was, Steven Spielberg was involved in this. This was one of the... there was a big period in which animation was created from scratch again. I think The Simpsons had helped pioneer it like in prime time. And then all of a sudden there were all these new original cartoon series being made. And some of them were really great. And again, Steven Spielberg was involved in this. So Animaniacs, which you know, Animaniacs, I'm sure.
Yes.
So that was a class. And I think that may have been the precursor. That was the first one. And that was a fantastic and crazy show. And I hear people like walking down the street, quoting Pinky and the Brain, like today, it had a lasting impact on.
Oh, Pinky and the Brain, we definitely had. Yeah.
Was that a separate show too at one point, wasn't it? So that started as a segment, very much like The Simpsons started on the Tracy Ullman show. Pinky and the Brain was a segment of the Animaniacs. So the Animaniacs had these rotating characters with some main things, and like the baby, you know, younger Bugs Bunny and the rest, or maybe his nephew or something is probably it. So Freakazoid. That is a show that is a treasure. If you can find it, you should watch it. It was crazy. It was crazy like Bullwinkle and Rocky was crazy. And it had those elements of being a lot of stuff there for adults, like lots of jokes. There's an extended scene in one episode that I will never forget, in which it's a parody of Hello, Dolly! With one of the supervillains. And it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. And Ricardo Montalban is one of the recurring regular voices on it. Asner is a recurring voice. The show is nuts. And Paul Dini was, isn't he a DC Comics guy, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, Paul Dini, I believe it's Paul Dini who wrote the first couple of new Batman games as well. You know, the Arkham Asylum games.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. So
which is one of the reasons they were so good.
Right. And he was involved. He was one of the creators of the show and helped, shape it. So Freakazoid is the, Freakazoid. God, was that a crazy show? But it had, I can't remember why I brought it up now. I'm sure there was a reason, but it's a precursor of Kim Possible. And a decade earlier. And, it had again, it used animation at impossible situations. It was a guy with kids in high school dealing with high school situations, which is a very, you know, nice little juvenile or a juvenilia kind of thing. And, it's still beloved. So I feel like Kim Possible follows in that tradition of being like these little great comedy stories with like either a super hero or super power element to it. And so Freakazoid, the character in that has, he falls into the internet or something, spills soda on his keyboard, and Tron like becomes charged with computer powers or something. And Kim Possible is non-powered. So like Batman, and also in contrast to Buffy. So Buffy is a slayer. She has super recovery power and super strength, and she's really a superhero, even though in the context of Buffy, they never discuss her as a superhero, but she is. It's magically powered.
Whereas Kim Possible is all about technology, more like a classic James Bond.
Yeah, she's athletic. James Bond scale athletic feats and fighting skills, but not whatever. The other thing I want to talk about with Kim Possible too is there's a great, I think one of the reasons the series maybe didn't do as well as it did at the time, because there's this transition that about what kinds of cartoons are for boys and girls. And Kim Possible was maybe it was a girls cartoon, even though it had all the things you want, had strong female leads. It passes the Bechdel test. There are often discussions among multiple women on the show about things that are not boys or men. There are like the supervillains, the other characters, like there was an incredible distribution. Kim is not a damsel in distress. She's sometimes rescued, but she's often rescuing her best friend, who then becomes her boyfriend late in the series.
I only watched a few episodes of this in order to sort of prep for the show, and it seemed about 50-50 in terms of whether she gets rescued or is the one doing the rescuing.
It's not haplessness, right? She doesn't get herself into binds. Her partner there, Ron Stoppable. So Kim Possible and Ron Stoppable, great names. Oh, and Patrick Warburton is one of the regular voices in it too, you know, from Putty, from Seinfeld. Patrick Warburton is he was the Tick in the live action Tick show. And
He
is like the most recurring voice of all time, I think, in animation as well. And he has a great role, basically drawn almost like him, but a more, got a great jaw. So Ron Stoppable, the guy, winds up being the damsel in distress. And I think it's realistically portrayed. He's less secure. She has real, you know, actual insecurities, but she's brilliant. She's capable. She's beautiful. He's kind of a schlub, but he's not an idiot. He's not a bad guy. He's a really good guy. He always tries. He never walks away from a struggle. But he is not as physically capable. Let's say he's not as adept. And so he doesn't always measure up. And one of the redemptions of the show, I think, is that at the end of the series, there's this running arc that he manages to get his own. He gets his own mystical powers, which is a bunch of funny series. And I think George Takei is the voice of a character that recurs, of a sensei, of course. It's either George Takei or someone doing a great George Takei impression, but I'm pretty sure it's him.
It's funny you should say that, because and that you should mention Ricardo Montalban, because in one of the early episodes where they meet the guy who has the multi-billionaire who has his own island, I could have sworn that was Ricardo Montalban doing the voice. Senor, his name is. And I could have sworn that was Ricardo Montalban doing the voice.
It is Ricardo Montalban.
Is it?
It is. It was one of the last things he did. And he had a record. This is the crazy thing.
I looked in the credits and I didn't see his name.
He's way down. I know, it's funny. He's way down. I was digging the other day and I couldn't find it. I found a full list. But this show was clearly either they had a pile of money, which they may have had, or I just found J.K. Simmons, who just won a Golden Globe. He's had a recurring role, too. He's actually a relative of friends of mine. That's funny. But if you look at the list of actors in this thing, including recurring parts, they had a crazy number of great people. Nicole Sullivan was on, I think it was, is it Mad TV or I think it was Mad TV was her thing. She is a fantastic voice. She's a great actress and, you know, sort of a live action actress, but she's made her real living in, as an animation of a voice artist. And she came from Mad TV. And Nicole Sullivan is one of the villains. And she, like, between her, so Dr. Draken is John DiMaggio, classic voice. He just released a movie actually not long ago, a documentary about voice artists, and Nicole Sullivan. These two people are Dr. Draken and Shigo are, you know, she's the sidekick, even though she does have superpowers. She's much smarter. She just isn't actually particularly interested in taking over the world. She's just sort of chaotic evil, right?
I couldn't quite figure out why she was there. Yeah, she seemed to have complete contempt for her boss.
It's a good recurring bit, though, because she has so much power. She could do, if she was really in charge, there's a great role reversal episode.
It was funny, yeah. I mean, I loved it. It was a great relationship, but it did have me scratching my head and maybe wondering, because like I say, I haven't seen that many of this, so it made me think, do we find out later on that she's in love with him or something, or is it just never explained?
Both of those things. Well, there is an origin episode somewhere in the middle where it turns out she was a superhero, and but the reason she went bad, it was more disgusted. She and her brothers all developed superpowers through some meteor or something. It's barely explained. And they're super. She's Shigo. Her brother is Higo, her like older brother. There's Migo, who is egotistical. And then I think Wego is a pair of twins with twin power. And they're in some other city. So at some point, they go to visit this city because of some fast food restaurant issue that Ron has, because he's a big fan of this one chain of fast food restaurants. And you find out the origin story. And so she's more, that's why I say chaotic evil. Like, she just got tired of her family and the superhero business and just said, forget it. I'm just going to go on the side of world conquering, whatever, but I'm not going to do it. So yeah, Patton Oswalt, Andrea Martin from SCTV days, just the like I say, they either had a pile of money or people like the show. And, and Phil Lamar. So Phil Lamar, I went to college with Phil, and I've kept in touch a little bit with him. He's the guy who gets shot in the back seat in Pulp Fiction. Where they actually,
oh, right.
Where they flip the gun around, that's Phil Lamar.
Marvin,
but
yeah.
Phil has been in, he's in this, of course. He's had a recurring role in Futurama, and Phil is Green Lantern. He's the John Stewart Green Lantern voice for all the green,
right.
And it's so, like, every great voice, it is George Takei, too, I just found. So every great voice actor has been in this, and then all of these sometimes supremely famous people also in this, because they must have just left. Felicity Huffman. I mean, just like, they have 100 actors listed, who had a guest shot. So the other thing is, I know as a, and you know this from the video game world too, I was watching, oh gosh, what was the movie I saw? We just saw, my wife and I just saw this new SpongeBob film, which is crazy. It's funny. It's nuts. And there was some actor, I forget who, she wondered how they got him. And I was like, well, he's in the animated part. So they literally, he was in a studio for a day, you know, maybe 2 days. And that's the whole thing. He wasn't in the live action part where you had to be out, you know, for weeks or whatever. And that's how they got him. It's like, it's a day work or 2 days work. And you're like, oh, this is great. How fun to be in this. And then you're off to your, you know, the rest of your work. And I think that gets forgotten with animation too. I forget that. You can get in, you know, you can get Ricardo Montalban in the studio to do a season's worth of taping in a day for 22 minute shows. He has 5 minutes of lines and you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're right. That does happen in games as well. It's as long as they can get over the stigma, it's relatively easy to get people like that because, yeah, you simply just don't need them in the studio for all that long. One of the things I want to quickly mention, you said quite rightly that it is still au courant in terms of technology, and, you know, there is, the internet exists, there are mobile phones, although obviously nobody has an iPhone. They're all flip phones and the like, which look terribly out of date now. But I must say, it is, for anybody who lived through the late 90s and early 2000s, there are so many things that just scream that period. Her fashion, the look of the character. She's got the belly shirt and then the big baggy cargo pants. I was having flashbacks to All Saints videos. The theme tune isn't helping, because that sounded almost like an All Saints track, or, you know, or Spice Girls or something. It was a good theme tune, but it was so of the time. And then I think in the very first or the second episode, they go snowboarding. It's like, oh my God, I'm having terrible flashbacks to, like, yeah, my mid-20s.
Oh, that's hilarious. You know, I forget about that, but you're right, because I'm used to the show. Yeah, it's absolutely even the guys, like Ron's wearing like an extended jersey, and I think he's always wearing cargo pants too, and even the skirts that are being worn, and
everybody's got pockets on their hips. Yeah,
because you needed pockets then, and now we don't need pockets because all we need is the cell phone. What I think was funny too is that there was the technology is both super advanced, because it's supposed to be extrapolating a little into the future. Like Wade has a worldwide communications network, the Computer Whiz, which lets him get to Kim anywhere, and they have two-way video conversations, and he basically has probably the capabilities that we all have today with FaceTime. Then, so some of it was ahead of its time and clearly like sci-fi-ish then, and now you're like, oh no, that's just technology. But the flip phone is what gets you. The fact that she has to open up the phone looks ridiculous, and then the capabilities are totally safe. And the other thing is, she never, you know, today, if they're making this show, there wouldn't be a Wade, there'd be an AI, right? There'd be like, you know, WDE, I need you to book. It'd be like, working, and it would flash stuff on the screen. It would send up a 3D heads-up display rotating in space.
I always forgive shows things like that, though, because it strikes me, it's kind of like, you know, the original Alien with all the CRT screens for the computers. You know, you look at any old sci-fi, really, with CRT screens now, and you're like, well, I didn't see that coming, did you? So you have to forgive a certain amount of those things.
The CRT explanation was, oh, well, these are more resilient. It turned out in deep space, all these LCD screens, they just all the plasma evaporated, so we couldn't use them, of course.
Excellent. Headcanon, I like it. Yeah. One of the other things I did like about this, and as I said, I didn't watch many, but I watched, you know, the first few, and One of the things that struck me, apart from the fact that some of them are clearly shown out of production order.
Yes.
That's, you know, sort of watching it now in retrospect, that's very obvious. But I have to say, I do find it refreshing that they, at least at first, really don't sort of go into any big, long expositions about who she is, what she does, why she has an arch villain, how she's a spy, her background. You know, it's all just kind of presented for you and you're just asked to sort of go along with it. And of course you do, because, you know, it's fun and you don't, to an extent, you don't really care. I'm sure that they will have addressed it. Well, I expect they will have addressed it later on in the series, but I do think that's something that a good few more so-called mature stories could take a lesson from. You know, you get every other superhero movie and reboot these days seems to be an origin movie. The rebooted Spider-Man that they're doing, everybody's saying, for God's sakes, please don't do another origin. But they probably will. And I think the success of this series goes to show that you really don't have to take that route. It's a classic mistake of talking down to the children, really, isn't it? And everybody assumes that kids need to know this stuff. But I think a lot of the time, they're quite happy to pick things up as they go along, and they can pick more things up as they go along than people give them credit for.
The worst thing to me in any media is when it is the horrible, unnecessary exposition, which means you didn't write it well enough to let people figure out as you go along, and the horrible recap of the end of what you just saw. The end of Kim Possible, the last episode, they do not do a recap montage of the entire series or even that episode. And I was, you know, pumped my hands in the air. Yay, they actually did it. I think the best films, you know, we saw, my wife and I saw Birdman, which is a very peculiar film and very difficult and weird. And the fact that nothing is explained in it. There is no explanation. You have to take it on its own merit. Are we looking in his head? Is this reality? Are people not see what he, like, is anything real? Is it, whatever. We don't know. We've got no idea. And the movie doesn't necessarily clue. It gives us a couple hints at the end, but even then it's not entirely clear. And I think not leading the audience by the nose is amazing. So yeah, I agree. Kim Possible drops you in. She just happens to be a supremely capable, organized, intelligent, non-superhero spy-ish. Not even, I don't know, she's like a non-author, she's like a non-government super agent.
She's a one-woman Thunderbirds, which, and there's a reference that only older listeners will get.
Oh, I've only seen a little bit of Thunderbirds, because it was never made its way here.
Oh, I grew up watching Gerry Anderson shows and Thunderbirds, the original puppet shows and stuff. Oh, yes.
We had H.R. Puff and stuff and the like, which were much more horrible and intended to be, of course, there were drug fantasies in there, we just didn't know that at the time. Yeah, but I think the Kim, and the other thing with Kim Possible is that it's presented straight. Like, this is the thing that I hate about a lot of comic media that doesn't work for me, is when you mug at the camera. So the original Airplane is fantastic. You watch Airplane. This is my contention about Airplane versus, what was the movie, Top Secret with Val Kilmer, that came out not long after.
Oh, yeah.
Airplane is played 100% straight. Everyone in that movie is behaving in their minds. They're not performing. That movie is serious, and it's the circumstances, things that occur that arise out of it. But they're absolutely acting in a serious fashion. Top Secret is 100% mugging, or The Man with One Red Shoe, I think. I forget if it was Tom Hanks, some version of that. It's like everything is mugging. Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, everyone is staring at the camera and going, ugh, or reacting to Jim Carrey. It's like, no, the material has to cause a reaction in your brain, and that is what is funny. And but, you know, Mr. Bean, I have never quite liked, but Mr. Bean is,
I'm not a big fan of Mr. Bean myself.
He's, you know, he's sort of this is, I like the later Blackadders versus the first season, right? That's the Mr. Bean versus the, I like the total bastard ones, not the simpering fool ones. But the thing that I would say is that Kim Possible, it plays it straight. Like, in this universe, everything is consistent. Whatever happens, whether it's science or magic or whatever, it's not played for laughs. Or it's not played for mugging. And then they'll do this thing. So I remember seeing decades ago, one of the creators of Looney Tunes, and I've forgotten, was it Chuck Jones? My dad took me to this lecture this guy was giving, and he showed, and it must have been like 7 or 8, and he was showing clips of this and talking about how they made the cartoons. It was amazing. So I still have this memory of it. And the thing that stuck with me most is he shows this clip, and it shows this dog being attacked by fleas, and the dog is running around like crazy trying to get the fleas off, and then it stops and says to the camera, you know, this isn't any fun for me either. And then it goes back to it, and he said, you know, we put that in there almost as a joke, we want to have that thing where it breaks it. And I thought, how amazing that you know, that you break the fourth wall in that limited way, but otherwise you're in that world. And I feel like This show and a lot of the cartoons I like best, they sometimes will reference the outside world, but really inside the world, it's entirely the world that they're working within. And it happens sometimes to be funny to us or serious or whatever.
Well, talking about references, one of the things that I noted, one of the things I liked about it was that they make a lot of references to outside media and, you know, but not on the level of something like Family Guy or even The Simpsons. I mean, you know, the music is very, you know, very James Bondian. You know, there's lots of like sort of almost quasi surf guitar. There are horns blasting occasionally during the action scenes. You know, it did remind me of a really good Bond score. There was, I think, in one of the episodes, I can't remember which, the one with the giant robot in the Chinese factory, there's a Star Wars reference, for heaven's sake, with the line sling around the robot's legs, you know, to like bringing down an AT-AT. I mean, that's got to be a deliberate reference. In one of the episodes, the one at the with the sort of nightmare summer camp, scenario. There's a Halloween style piano riff going on as Ron is telling the story of his nightmares at summer camp. I was like, I had to rewind. I was like, wait a second. That's, I mean, it's not, obviously it's not quite the same. It's not the exact riff, but it's a very...
It was the worst summer of all time. I swore I'd never come back to Camp Wanaweep. Never!
Oh, I didn't remember that. That's great.
And then in another episode, this is the last one I noted, they used the $6 million man sound effect. Mm-hmm. You know, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They used that when somebody throws something, you know, and it's a kind of, it's a bit of an epic moment.
Diablo sauce, stat!
So clearly, they weren't afraid of making these references again, presumably for the adults watching, because there's no way the kids would have got these at all. But for the adults watching or the older teens, all this stuff is there. And they don't make a big deal of it. They don't hang a lantern on it. They don't point it out. It's just there for you to notice.
Well, and even the character names, it's great character names. They have things like, I was a Duff Killigan. It's a great one. He's a Scot who's uses golfing as, you know, his weapons, his golf balls explode and things like that. And it's ridiculous, but it's also like, what a funny idea that they would do that. So there's Professor Dementor, which I think someone tries to call him Dr. Dementor. At one point, he said, Professor Dementor. I'm like, that's a nice little joke for those of us old enough to remember listening to the radio. Another element of it is that everything exists there within a really positive attitude towards science. So even though science is sort of ridiculous, there's still her mother is a psychologist. Her father is a rocket scientist. And there's like a NASA branch, not called NASA, right nearby or something. And there's a lot of reference like to space observation to, I mean, not that it's accurate, but there's this kind of continuous expectation that people need to know that there's a scientific knowledge that's being used, being exploited. And I don't know. I think that's great too.
No, I understand what you mean. It is very science positive. There's no, yes, you have the mad scientist, evil villains and stuff, but you know, technology, so much technology is used because, as you said, Kim has no powers herself. Right. So she has to rely on technology, which of course, you know, is a scientific thing. And yeah, it's very, you know, you have the GPS networks and the satellite trackers and all the gadgets and tech and stuff, much like Bond, you know, the science and technology is not something to be feared and shunned.
Right. She has a Q. Her Q is Wade. And she doesn't have an M. There's no dispatcher, right? That's the interesting part. She is essentially, people submit stuff to her website and Wade watches it. It's like, oh, there's, you know, the government of Australia needs you to fly down.
Well, this is why I made the Thunderbirds reference, you see. It did kind of, it struck me as similar in that sort of people sending out, you know, cries of distress that she just then picks up on, or rather Wade picks up on, and off she goes.
Yeah, I know the one other thing I would have mentioned about Ron, too, was there was a great episode. So Freaky Friday, role reversal things are always, you know, that's a staple in time travel, all staples of every kind of thing where you don't have to pay for sets, right?
Sure.
Like, hey, we'll put him in the past. Great, we'll just draw different backgrounds. But they had one episode where, I forget the exact mechanism, but Ron and Ron Stoppable and Dr. Drac and her arch enemy, who's essentially incompetent, he comes up with great plans, never able to bring them to fulfillment. And sometimes his enemies bring them to fulfillment, which is great. They steal his plan and make it work. But so Dr. Drac and he, they have their personalities exchanged or something. So same memories, but like now Ron is evil and Dr. Drac is good. Well, it turns out Ron is super fantastic at being evil. And he actually immediately comes up with some crazy thing that he winds up about to take over the world, and he's, you know, he's like laughing, ah, ha, 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 doing crazy laugh and whatever. And the goal there is to reverse the personalities to get them back to nice Ron and like incompetent Dr. Draken, because a competent version of Dr. Draken is a terrible thing. And I thought that was it was actually amusing. It was part of again, foreshadowing, because Ron can be competent in the right circumstance. He has an arc. I mean, this is the thing. Kim has very little arc. She's not an unappealing character, and she's not bland. She goes through her own things, but she's always from start to finish kind of her own thing. Ron is the character who experiences growth, and so do some of the other characters. You know, Wade actually finds he's kind of agoraphobic, and he winds up coming out and like seeing people. And but Ron has the real journey from being a schlub to being actually stepping up in the last episode and actually saving the day after everybody else has done an enormous amount of work. Sort of the last thing where now we're failing. It's like, no, there's Ron, and then his mystic monkey power comes out and he saves the day.
I must say that if nothing else, I'm glad that an original series, something that isn't a reboot or a retro thing or based on an existing property or a spin-off, was this successful. I'll be honest, I'm much more comfortable with adults enjoying an original series like this that is made with deliberate knowing winks and references, as we've talked about, compared to stuff like My Little Pony or even like most modern Transformers cartoons, which is made for kids. It gets an adult audience purely out of nostalgia, but the actual, you know, it's not aimed at them, even on a sort of second level, which isn't, I mean, I kind of feel the same way about a lot of superhero fiction. That's a whole another bag of worms. But it's just nice to see something original, something that was clearly not, I mean, yeah, okay, it's inspired by James Bond, obviously, but something that isn't a reboot of something else. It's not a continuation of an existing IP. It's not a spin-off. It's not cashing in on retro nostalgia. It was just an original series, and it was quite successful. And, you know, it's incredibly sad how rare that is these days.
I agree. I think it was inspired by, but none of the plots are, or maybe there's little takeoffs in the plots, but every script was original. I was looking up the screenwriters too, and the scriptwriters, the two creators wrote or have credits on every script, and 86 episodes. And you don't see that on, unfortunately, on even like mainstream television. On people leave, you know, they'll be the showrunner for a few years and they go, or they may not have their hand in every script. So an advantage of animation too is that I think you can have, for something like this, you can and sometimes have to have your hand in all of it. So it's consistent. It's the same voice and it shows. And yeah, it's original. There are things that I've seen in Kim Possible that I've never seen elsewhere, like storylines or ideas and things like, you know, plot points. And that is truly remarkable. I think Disney did an incredible job. They had so many original series, and some of them were very low budget, kind of ridiculous live action that were absolutely aimed at kids and were intolerable to adults, even to sit there in the same room and watch, right? And then they had things like this. And, you know, more recently, here, I think the greatest tragedy in animation in the last few years is Tron Revolution. Did you watch any of that?
I didn't even know. I assume that's an animated sort of continuation. I didn't even know it existed.
Produced by Disney on, I think it's their X screen, or I'm sorry, Tron Uprising. Excuse me. That's what it's called. And it was produced by Disney, you know, it was funded. It was shown on Disney XD.
Well, Disney owns Tron, yeah. So.
Right. They have the property. And so this was, I think, an extraordinary show, not unflawed. They only shot a short preview that they distributed free, like on Boing Boing and other sites. And then how many episodes? I think only 18 episodes were made, and then it was canceled. But it had Elijah Wood, Bruce Boxleitner did a voice in it. Nate Cordry, like Lance Henriksen. I mean, all these people, Paul Rubens had a recurring role. I mean, so great voices, incredible animation, sophisticated, weird plots. Do you remember, this is go back, this is part of my journey of all the all the crazy things. Do you remember Phantom 2040? Did you ever see this show?
I'm not familiar with that. Oh, that God. May be a transatlantic, you know, issue.
This was, what was it called? It was a TV, Phantom 2040, that's what it's called. I have found very few people have seen it. I don't think it's available in any format. Two seasons, 1994, it was, I think, one of the most extraordinary things ever to air on television in animated form. It pushed at every angle. Oh, and again, had incredible voices. Margot Kidder, Ron Perlman, recurring voice, Mark Hamill, like all these recurring parts. It had deep moral ambiguity that would leave you chilled. It was like watching little feature films. There's a bit where this one guy who's like a cyborg, you know, his body's been destroyed. He's a cyborg, mostly machine. He's sort of a relentless general, leads this, the government forces against the Phantom, who's, you know, been reborn or whatever from the old comic books. And the Phantom is the good guy, right? He's trying to undermine this repressive society, sort of. And there's ambiguity about that too. So this evil general guy, there's a bit where they're in some manufactured city and there's this kid who's under Phantom's protection. And the general comes out walking out with this kid in his arms. The Phantom's like, what did you do to him? He said, this is no place for children. Take him and go away. And you're like, there's no room for that in cartoons, is there? And I remember just thinking, this is what it should be about. Not every show should be that serious. And, I think that the next thing I saw like that on TV, like Batman the Animated Series, this is sort of in the same era. Phantom 2040 came after that, and I think was trying to build on that success. But the next thing I saw after that really was Tron Uprising. That same degree of, it's not funny. It's deadly serious. People die, not all the time. And there's a consequence, and there's moral. Some like in episodes of Tron Uprising, someone does something they think is right, and it winds up being the worst thing they could do. But they're acting. Or there's a character who's again on the side of the government. It turns out her motivations are completely twisted around. She's been abused and exploited for her position. So you know, I love that can be done. I wish there was more of that. So Tron Uprising, that's the greatest thing you haven't seen. It's on iTunes. You can watch it.
Speaking of, I've just actually looked it up, and I'm not, obviously I can't speak for the American store, but in the UK store you can buy all four series of Kim Possible on iTunes.
I should just do that. I bet they have cheap prices now too.
Yeah, well, it did strike me when you said that it wasn't available, and I thought, well, hang on a second, if it's Disney, you know, we know Disney and Apple have a very comfortable, cozy relationship in terms of media for movies and TV and stuff. So yeah, it would surprise me if it's not available in the US iTunes store.
Yeah, and Tron, and I know I've bought Tron Uprising also because again, Disney. Yeah, it's Kim Possible. I don't think you can. I don't think you can stream it anywhere. I think you have to get I think it's on DVDs, and
right,
you have to buy it
rather than stream it,
which is a bummer. I think they did. I think they did stream it in the past, and I don't think they stream it now. Is the thing. I think you have to. You have to actually get them on DVD. You can get them if you have the DVD version of Kim Possible, or buy it. It's an interesting thing that when older series that you think have some legs, you wonder, why don't they just stream it? Because then they could make, you know, a couple dollars an episode a month. Where is anyone actually buying it from iTunes at this point? But
it's free money, essentially, yeah.
There's one last thing I wanted to say. I realized I didn't say this the whole thing. We're talking about a female teenaged character who's presented as beautiful in the show. There is zero sexualization of her or sexual exploitation, which one would expect because it's Disney. But the portrayal of her and the other female characters is never portrayed in a way that if there was, I would be completely uncomfortable with the show and I wouldn't be able to watch it. I'd be like, oh,
it's never salacious.
Yeah. It's not salacious. It's very funny. And they're presented realistically. And there's some variation even in body types, not a ton, but there is some in the show as well. But I wanted to point that out because that's the thing where you would hope that there would be none of that in a show like this. And there really isn't. They did a very nice job with that.
Right. But so often there is, isn't there? You know, especially in the ones that are aimed at boys.
Exactly.
So I know what you mean. It is nice to see that, especially given that this is a relatively old show. So it's not like they're riding on the current wave of body positivism and stuff. You know, this was, what, 13, 14 years ago, this show was started broadcasting. So yeah, that was quite forward looking and good to see.
They could have stuck her in a bikini, like a non-revealing bikini. They could have done all kinds of things. The worst thing you see is her belly button. And they never put people in a position. Again, it's Disney, I know. But you see, sometimes I see the most inappropriate things, I think, not in terms of like, oh no, my children shouldn't see it, but more like, I don't like the set of juxtaposition of concepts. Like, I don't care about it. It's not the skin or the words or whatever. You're like, this is supposed to be for kids. And my children are so under television. We will watch Jeopardy sometimes, and you know, we've got it taped. And before I fast forward through the commercial, sometimes we'll watch commercials and they'll say, that's totally inappropriate. They shouldn't show that. That commercial shouldn't be on during Jeopardy. That's how sensitized they are. Anyway, thank you. Sorry. That was my last point.
So, Glenn, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, I just launched a new podcast with Christina Bonnington, who's a staff writer for Wired Magazine, called Not Enough Time in the Week, and it's at timeintheweek.com, and we're going to do a sort of, like, if you're somebody who's interested in technology and you are overwhelmed, it's going to be not exactly an explainer, but we're going to talk through current events in tech and try to piece out, like, what actually happened. So we talked, like, in the last episode about Samsung potentially listening into your conversations via your television set, and the launch of the Discover satellite, which is going to be doing space weather prediction and what that means for our fine planet. So that's it. And on Twitter, I'm at Glenn F, GlennF, and I recommend not following me because I tweet too much.
And I'll bet you Kim Possible's already hacked into that satellite.
That's right. I'm sure someone's using it to cause solar flares from the Lagrange L1 point. They'll be sending solar flares our way, and she's the only one who can prevent that happening.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, Episode 8, with Anthony Johnston and Glenn Fleischman. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, and yeah, genuinely, thank you for sort of, you know, exposing me to, as I say, I had heard of this series because of that friend of mine who worked at Disney, but I'd certainly never watched it, partly because, although I'd heard that it was, you know, one of these things, as you say, that's kind of good for girls in that it's, you know, it's not sexualized and it's a female action hero and stuff, nobody had ever said, oh, and, you know, it's actually quite good even if you're an adult. And having, yeah, watched a few episodes now, I may well watch some more because I really enjoyed them.
Well, she's part of the long series of female geek crush characters that I've had in my life, right? And so I was too old to appropriately have a crush on a fictionalized teenage red-haired girl. I also have a thing for redheads, which many men do, I realize.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not a
Join
Scot.
The club.
So, yeah, exactly. So I did not marry everyone. I think all my friends are married redheads. I did not marry a redhead. My wife said her, you know, she's thought about dyeing her hair for me at times, but hasn't. But yeah, but so Gadget Hack Wrench from the otherwise terrible Chippendale Rescue Rangers series, which is kind of awful. I watched that when TV couldn't be recorded easily and watched later. I'd get off work or something, I'd watch that. But Gadget Hack Wrench is a mouse, and she was adorable, and she was a geek, and she could, I mean, it wasn't a computer, it's like she could repair anything, make anything. She's an engineer, and all the guys around her were idiots, basically. It's like, this is what I'm looking for. I want a Gadget Hack Wrench in my life. So
that reminds me of I think her name was April, the female engineer character from Airwolf, who was also a redhead.
Oh, I loved. Oh my God! Right, she came in later season.
Yeah. She joined in like season 3 or something, and she was one of my, you know, young boy crushes, definitely. And she, yeah, very handy with a wrench. You know, wasn't sexualized in any way. She was just kind of, I'm the engineer. You're all idiots. Get out of my way and let me repair this.
Airwolf was the worst thing, and I watched every episode of that damn terrible show. You know what drove me crazy about Airwolf? Have you ever played a stringed instrument?
Oh, yes, Gianmarco Vincent and his cello.
He would hold his bow, he would put his hand over the horsehair part of the bow and clasp it while talking. I thought, all you needed was cello consultant on that, or a bass, bass consultant on that show, to make sure he doesn't do that. Every time he did it, he'd go, ah! Show his sensitive side as he played it on the dock. Terrible place to play a string instrument, over water, you're going to ruin the instrument. And then you put your hand on the horsehair, it's going to destroy that bow.
April should have told him. I bet she would have known that.